Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. New rules on airport security go into place following the president's speech. All airports will now become nudist colonies. Palm releases new cell phones that create Wi-Fi hotspots. No, not G-spots, the other kind of hotspot. Joe Lieberman is losing support. The holding of the World Cup could spread AIDS. We'll explain. Hey, sailor, want a little more stimulus? Congress may help. A gay marriage bill was defeated in New Jersey. Tony Soprano is jubilant. Rumors continue to persist that Jay Leno may return to The Tonight Show. Does anyone really care about this story? Anyone? Airlines on-time records hit an all-time high. It's easier to achieve than you think. The newest concern in the economy, a housing double dip. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That's me. All of that, news of the weird, and a great guest, Sabrina Sumpson, who will talk about publicity and writing and books. But first, an announcement. Our book, The Mobile Millionaire, has a new website. We had given you the website for that book previously. It's a guidebook for the small investor who may wish to think about investing in mobile homes, which is something we've done for about 5 years, for the purpose of wealth accumulation and income. And the new spot on the web is mobilemillionaire, one word, .blogspot.com. And as said, the book deals with how to conduct a mobile home business, how to get started, how to do the business with little or no money, and how to deal with tenants. It's got forms, the whole thing. And again, that website is mobilemillionaire.blogspot.com. Getting back to the stories we headlined, rules on airport security really don't sound like they're going to affect too many of us too much from what they said. Both during the president's speech, in terms of what the president said, and in terms of all of the comments later, there's supposed to be greater partnership between the airports at foreign countries and Homeland Security here. Frankly, it sounds like there's not a lot of changes to be made. However, there is supposed to be more centralization in the intelligence community regarding how to deal with people who are believed or reported to be threats, such as the gentleman who just, not the gentleman, such as the suspect who is accused of committing the latest attempt at bringing down an airplane, the one that was landing in Detroit. The good news is that if the worst had happened and that plane had crashed and made a terrible mess in Detroit, no one would have been able to tell. Joe Lieberman, the senator from Connecticut, who is designated as an independent, he, as those of you who are aware will remember, had been elected to the Senate originally as a Democrat and ran on the Democratic ticket in 2000 as the vice presidential candidate of Al Gore. He then in the last election, sided with John McCain. But before that, he lost the Democratic primary in Connecticut, then decided to run as an independent, and actually won the election. He has caucused with the Democratic Party, but he almost single-handedly defeated the Senate health care reform bill by holding out and threatening to vote in favor of the filibuster that the Republicans were attempting to get off the ground. In any event, it turns out, we have the story here, it turns out that among Democrats in Connecticut, 81% now disapprove of his job, 14% approve, 5% have no opinion or aren't sure. Among Republicans, 48% disapprove of him, and only 39% approve. His strength, to the extent it exists, is among independents. I beg your pardon. His strength is even waning among independents. 61% of independents disapprove. So what it adds up to is that He's got a 25% approval rating with a 67% negative rating. And Barack Obama's approval rating in Connecticut, among Republicans in Connecticut, is higher than Lieberman with the state's Democrats. So there is some possibility he may have some trouble being reelected should he choose to do that, which is bad news for Senator Lieberman and, frankly, good news for many of us. But additionally, it's not all bad for him because the way he's been acting in the Senate, he, of course, could always get a job after he completes his term with health insurance companies. When the Senate returns to work on January 19th, they will be dealing with a bill that was first passed by the House with regards to a job creation package. This has been called Stimulus 2 or Son of Stimulus. The bill is actually called, as it was titled in the House, Jobs for Main Street. Okay, and it's the idea behind it is to spend about $8.4 billion on public transit and $27.5 billion for highway projects, along with another $23 billion for education to help prevent teacher layoffs within the state. Well, the idea obviously behind this is to promote jobs, which are slow in returning, although it is expected to be reported shortly that we had a quarter in the last quarter that that resulted in a growth for the gross domestic product. With that growth, it will be said that the recession is over. The classic definition of a recession is two quarters in a row of negative growth or, in fact, loss in the gross domestic product. If the quarter proves to be productive, that is a growth in GDP, then the recession will be officially over, unless you don't have a job, of course. but that's the fact. And as we've discussed on this show before and has been said many other places, unemployment is a lagging indicator. It is a long time after the recession ends that unemployment improves, or employment improves more correctly. We are going to be in a situation where we have an end to a recession, but jobs still lag behind, and that's as it always is. The reason that's so profound this time around is because the recession was so deep. As most of you know who follow these kinds of things, it is the worst recession or economic contraction, as economists call it, since the Great Depression of the 1930s. As a result, the unemployment rate is very high, although there has been one other time when the current unemployment rate was reached since the Great Depression, and that was during the administration of Ronald Reagan. But the unemployment rate during the Depression was actually 25%, which is enormous, approximately 2.5 times what it is now. And, of course, that did not count, as the current rate does not, the numbers of people who are described as discouraged workers, that is, people who stop looking. So, although it's obviously terrible to have an unemployment rate in excess of 10%, the end of a recession should help ameliorate that in a fairly short time. But we're still going to have a constant unemployment rate, which has been higher, which will be higher than it has been over time, mainly because of the loss of jobs to overseas manufacturing. In any event, that's what Congress is thinking about doing, is spending more money to improve the creation of jobs and the prevention of loss of jobs. And one of the reasons that everybody's concerned is because housing prices for the first time have actually taken a dive. Housing sales have taken a dive. They'd been on the increase for several months, which everybody saw as a good sign in terms of the economy's recovery, which it is. But now that has reduced. My opinion is you'll see it go up and down, but the fact that it has gone down is seen as a sign of for some concern. And as a result, the bill that passed in the House, the Jobs for Main Street Act, it will be before the Senate when the Senate returns to work in about a week and a half, and they're expected to take up the bill and change it and do what legislators do, debate it, change it. There may be a filibuster attempt by the Republicans again. If all of that is meandered through and the bill passes and the president signs it, then there will be some additional spending on the economy. The real question is whether that's really necessary. Not all of the stimulus dollars that were created by the first stimulus program have been spent yet. So it's always difficult to determine if more is needed. And while we all want to see jobs pick up and want to see job losses eliminated or greatly reduced, the fact is we don't know if the additional stimulus may create more of a problem down the line when inflation does come back and rears its ugly head. Oddly enough, you never hear anybody talking about anyone or anything rearing its very nice head, but I'm not sure why that is. We mentioned earlier as well, the gay marriage bill was defeated in New Jersey, in the New Jersey Senate. It had passed the lower house of the New Jersey legislature, and the Senate was considering it, and they defeated it. It needed 25 votes to pass. It got 14. The advocates for the gay marriage bill were trying to pass it before Governor John Corzine leaves office. He had said he'd sign it if the legislature passed it. They did not. The concern is, on the part of the advocates for the bill, is that if the state legislature passed a gay marriage bill with the new governor, after the new governor comes into office, Mr. Christie, he has said he would veto it. So that was the effort being made, to pass it while Corzine is still in office. That effort failed. New Jersey will not become the sixth state to approve of gay marriage. There is a story that's floating around in the media that Jay Leno may return to The Tonight Show, cancel the 10 o'clock show that he's got on, 9 o'clock Central Mountain Time, and Conan O'Brien would still have a show. It would be pushed back, and then Jimmy Fallon's show would be pushed back. I confess to you, I've seen one episode of Conan O'Brien's Tonight Show. I thought he did an okay job. I've seen zero episodes of Jay Leno's new show and none of Jimmy Fallon. I'm sure they're all terrific hosts, but I just haven't seen any of them. But in any event, apparently not too many more people have seen Jay Leno's new show because it's kind of bombing. The NBC says it's about what they expected, not that it bombed, but the ratings buildup would be slow. But the affiliates are very upset, because that's the hour coming before their local news. And local news is where local stations make their money. And if the lead-in is poor, let's say you're an NBC affiliate in Podunk, and Podunk, as you know, is right next to Mitz Rayim on the map. If you are in Podunk and you're waiting for and your local news is coming on at, depending on your time zone, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock after the Jay Leno hour, and the lead-in is bad, obviously, because the ratings for Jay Leno are poor, and the other local station that's a network affiliate, say for CBS or ABC, has a strong lead-in, their news will lead, your ratings will go down, and therefore your ad rates with your potential advertisers will suffer. Well, nobody wants to have that happen. So, according to the story, they're working with the local affiliates to see what they can do to strengthen the lead-in. By the way, I have failed one of my tasks as a host, for which I apologize. The call-in number, if you'd like to talk about politics, media, anything we've discussed tonight or in our prior shows, please feel free to join us. The call-in number is area code 347-994-3796. Repeating, 347-994-3796. In a little while, and with more precision, I'll tell you, in about 10 or 15 minutes, we'll be joined by Sabrina Sumption, who will be talking about, among other things, writing, books, publication, and publicity. And she will have some tips for writers and others about publicizing yourself. That almost sounds dirty, doesn't it? Well, there you are. We talked. Oh, airlines. Got to tell you about airlines. Airlines in the United States, domestic airlines, are rated by the Department of Transportation of the federal government based on their on-time records. Okay, now, the airline's on-time records hit an all-time high. Hard to believe, but, well, first off, the fact that they've hit an all-time high simply means that they've been on time more than they have generally been in the past. Okay, well, that's great, especially if you're a flyer. Although it's hard to believe from all the stories in the news about how flights have been delayed. But what's really peculiar is that it's more or less meaningless for the flights most of us take. And here is why. Most flights are between 1 hour and 2 hours. What's not generally known is that an airplane is considered on time if it takes off or lands. Let's talk about landing. If it lands within 20 minutes of its scheduled time. Now, 20 minutes may not seem like that big a deal, but if you're only flying an hour, say from L.A. to San Francisco, L.A. to San Francisco or Phoenix to L.A., both of flights of which are about an hour, and you're landing 19 minutes late, you're still considered on time. 19 minutes late on an hour flight is, whatever that is, a third of the time late. But not according to the way the government keeps its statistics on flights. So, for what it's worth, the airline's on-time records hit a new high, and that's collectively. So, if for example, and I'm making these up, but if Delta is always late and Southwest is always on time, again by virtue of this, it's the average or the number of flights that are on time, and how that compares with previous numbers. So, for what it's worth, they have done that. We'll have more, but I wanted to tell you about another company of ours that may be of interest to you if you have a furry animal. A furry child is what I meant to say, if you have an animal at home. And it's called Petlane. We, my wife and I, are what are called pet advisors. And what that means is that we provide products for pets. And that would be food, it would be accessories, and so forth. Petlane is a terrific company, and obviously we're involved with them. If you are interested in getting something neat, perhaps a belated holiday gift for your furry child, let me invite you to go to petlane.com/Bushman, B-U-S-H-M-A-N. Have a little news of the weird. News of the weird is available on a website, and you'll also find it as a newspaper column around the country. But the website, if you're interested in going there, is newsoftheweird.com. And here's a couple of stories from the last web update that they did. Several of them. Here's a collection. The Thorpe Park Amusement Facility in Chertsey, England. This is obviously a story from this last summer. Posted signs on its roller coaster admonishing riders, people riding the roller coaster, not to wave their arms during the ride. Now, I'm not a big roller coaster rider, but if you ever see the pictures of people on roller coasters, they always throw their arms into the air and go, ah! Okay, but that. And if anyone's trying to write up a transcript of the show, that was, you can spell it any way you want. But according to the director at the amusement facility, he says, we found when the temperature tops 77 degrees Fahrenheit, the level of unpleasant underarm smells can become unacceptable, and we receive complaints. Back about a million years ago when we were on our honeymoon in New Orleans, New Orleans is a lovely place. We were on a honeymoon there, and we attempted to travel by public transport. One of the buses we got on, there was someone on the bus who apparently took a page from the book of people riding on the roller coaster in England. The smell was so bad. How bad was it? The smell was so bad that you would have thought that we were in a toxic waste dump. Open windows, going to a different part of the bus, nothing worked. The only thing that might have worked is if we had happened to have clothespins that we could have put on our nose. But it was awful. Thank God he didn't. The fellow who was there didn't wave his arms. Here's a report, for what it's worth, going back to the late Pope, not the current one, who presumably is often on time. Pope John Paul II, according to a report released a couple of months ago, was revealed to have periodically atoned for sins by privately whipping himself, according to a nun who worked with him and who was cited in the Vatican's consideration of John Paul II for sainthood. The nun said she heard him distinctly several times from an adjacent room whipping himself. And, okay, I'm going to let you do the punchline. this is one, never mind. Moving on to the next story. Actually, before I move on to the next story, let me invite you again, either now or when we have our guest, in the event you have any questions of her regarding publicity and books and writing, our phone number for you to call in is 347-994-3796. And I also want to, let me go ahead and give you this next story. And then we'll take a little bit of a break before Sabrina joins us. A police report in the North Ontario, in the North Bay Nugget in Ontario in Canada, reports that an officer in line at a traffic light, realizing that the cars in front of him had not moved through two traffic light changes, two cycles. So he got out of his car to investigate. He walked up to the lead car. The driver said she couldn't move on the green light, and that's why she had continued to just stop there. Because in Ontario, being on the phone while you're driving is illegal. And since she was still on the phone, if she drove, she would be subject to getting a ticket. And she didn't want to do that, so she just stayed at the stop light. by the way, I will share with you, moving from the humorous to the political, I think the places where they have laws, where we are, there is no such law, but places where they have laws which say that effectively you cannot drive while talking on the phone are probably idiotic. If you cannot drive and talk on the phone at the same time, you probably can't drive, my opinion. I have seen people not driving, but walking in a parking lot down the middle of the aisle and talking on their cell phone and just continuing to either stand still or walk right down the middle of the aisle and blocking traffic completely unaware. So those folks shouldn't drive and talk on the phone. But for everybody else, I mean, you're dealing with your radio, your CD player, your iPod. None of those are against the law, but in many places, talking on your cell phone while driving is. We are now bringing in, I hope, to the conversation. I think we got her. Sabrina, are you there? There you are. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we are joined now, as you can tell by my high technical prowess, by Sabrina Sumption. And her website, incidentally, is sabrinasumption.com. That's S-A-B-R-I-N-A, S again, as in Sam, U-M-S again, I-O-N.com. And we'll mention that again during the show. But welcome.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you. And it's a pleasure for me to be on my show, as a matter of
fact.
I'm sorry?
I said I can understand that.
Well, thank you. You are a publicist. I know you know that, but I'm letting everyone else know. And in order to start at the very basic level, we can't assume that everyone knows what a publicist even is or does. So why don't you tell us?
Well, that's a great place to start, Jeff. I agree. A publicist, and I am specifically a literary publicist, so I work with authors. What we do is we work with people and try to help them gain public awareness. And we do that through setting up book signings or different events. And we also do that through setting up media interviews, media reviews, and just any way that we can help that author become a household name is what we do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in terms of just that, you also, as I understand it, also provide information to authors and others about what they can do themselves as well.
Oh, yes.
In the absence of using a publicist.
Yes, it's a really big push for me right now to teach authors what they can do themselves before hiring someone else to do it for them. And the reason this is a big push for me is, as I've been working over the years with several different authors, they choose publishing routes where everything is upon them. And just to see their book in print, they go into debt by thousands of dollars. And so mm-hmm. once you start talking about adding a publicist on top of that, you're adding an additional thousands of dollars to hire someone to do things for you. And many times it's things that authors can really do for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it just started to really, really bother me after a while that these authors were going into debt by, you know, $5,000 and $10,000 to get publicity for their books. And because of the publisher that they chose or because of just different factors, there was a very slim chance they would ever see even half of it back.
Well, let me ask you a question, you know, what may be an obvious question. Are you not to some extent, and I know you've obviously thought about this, but are you not to some extent kind of shooting yourself in the foot by advising people how to operate, advising authors specifically, how to operate without using the services of someone such as yourself?
Well, honestly, it is something that I did struggle with for a while. But
mm-hmm.
in the end, I can't sleep at night if I know that an author is going to lose their home. I mean, that's
well,
the
sure.
stories that I hear is these authors are investing money and they're leveraging their home, they're leveraging their cars, they're
mm-hmm.
leveraging so many things in their lives. And I just sit here and go, you know, there are some authors who need me. There are some authors who need to do things on their own first. And I would rather teach them how to do it on their own rather than know that they're going into debt.
I understand.
And that's how it is for me.
No, listen, there in any kind of business field, there are relatively few people who really have a high moral base. I'm not talking about people being dishonest or disingenuous or anything like that. But mm-hmm. for a lot of folks, it's whatever business I can get. If someone makes a decision to use me, I'm going to go ahead and provide them the service and charge them the fee. It takes,
right.
you don't need me to, you know, tell you what a wonderful person you are, but it takes someone who has a high level of morality to say, okay, let's talk about whether it's wise for you to use me or not, in terms of economics and what I can do for you and what you could do for yourself. That's, you know, that. Again, at the risk of sounding like I'm, heaping praise, that's highly admirable.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Now, let's talk about how the authors do go into debt.
Okay.
You're talking about authors who are, quote-unquote, self-publishing, correct?
Mm-hmm. I sure am. And there's
All
two
right.
different ways that you can consider an author self-published. Sometimes they
Please.
Use the publisher, which I will generalize and call this whole group Vanity Press. There's
mm-hmm.
a lot of authors and publishers who will say, well, we're not Vanity Presses, we're self-publishers. But I'm just going to lump them all into one group for simplicity. It is any company
okay.
who an author has to pay for any services related to releasing their book, whether it's publicity, whether it's printing, whether it is cover design, whether it is a manuscript evaluation or editing. Anytime an author pays the publishing company for any service, I'm lumping them all into the vanity publishing term, just for simplicity.
Okay, and before we go further in there, let's also explain, because I know that there are a bunch of authors who are listening to this and nodding their head, saying, yeah, that's right. But there are also a lot of people who may just be potential authors or who know little about this, who are not aware of what the more traditional route was in terms of writing and getting a book published. So why don't you outline that briefly first so we can see what the distinction is.
Okay, well, a traditional publisher, under my definition, and there's a lot of definitions you can find on the Internet,
sure.
they don't charge upfront fees. I mean, that's the biggest one right there.
Mm-hmm.
They have high editorial standards. they pay a very respectable advance for the right to publish your work. And I'm not talking about a dollar. A dollar is not a respectable advance. they pay royalties.
Yeah.
Well, and I know of a particular company that they pay a dollar, and that is their way of saying, hey, we're a traditional publishing house. But they're not a commercial publishing house. And that's
right.
Where the distinction is. A commercial publishing house is making their money off of selling your book, not off of selling you services. So these traditional commercial publishing houses, the mainstream publishers, they pay their royalties. They don't charge any fees for editing, cover design, any miscellaneous part of publishing whatsoever. They print a large run of books, and a run of books means that several books are printed at the same time, and by several, I'm talking 1,000 or more. And they're doing a large run with an offset press. And an offset press has those long rolls of paper that just go along. And then as they go through the press, they've got different cutters that just make chop suey out of it. And then somehow the pages all end up in the right order. And they're all bound at the same time. So that's an offset press. These print-on-demand companies, a lot of these vanity publishers, they do short runs, which are typically printed out on something similar to a household printer.
Right.
And then they're all bound together and cut up with a nice paper cutter, and then you have a book. And doing it the printer route, the small runs, it costs a lot more because there's a lot more human interaction, so you're paying for labor fees. These offset printing machines, you've got somebody, they press a button, the machine starts going, and there's pretty much little else that has to be done by a human, so it costs so much less.
And of course, you're also getting the benefit of the volume production, and since and the author isn't paying for it. And basically, what you're talking about too, anything I say, feel free to correct, is the again in the old days in the commercial and still done to some extent in terms of the old model, is you would write a book, and then get it either through an agent or directly to a publisher. The publisher would pay this advance. And get a contract signed because they believe the book they could, you know, sell the book.
Right.
And when it comes to a vanity publisher, since they are charging you to exercise your vanity, because you'll pay to have it printed and so forth, they don't really care if the book will sell or not because they're making their money based on the fact that you're paying to have them printed.
Right. And that's why I really encourage a lot of authors who there are some authors who don't need a traditional commercial publisher. There are some authors who are using it for back-of-the-room sales. There are some authors who can reach their fan base, and they can do their own marketing, and they don't need the help from the publisher. And those authors I encourage to just use a printing press, just use a printing company, and just bypass these vanity publishers altogether.
Right. Now, when you're talking about back of the room sales, you're talking about a situation where someone is, in addition to a writer, is typically a speaker or is a salesperson, a marketer, and they're selling the book in the back of the room where they're speaking.
Exactly. Thank you for clarifying that for me.
No, it's one of the things that happens, and I'm in a field where this happens a lot in terms of some of my normal work, quote unquote. Is we have a tendency to use terminology that most of the people we're speaking with understand, but if anybody else is listening, it's kind of like listening to two pipe smokers discussing their tobacco blends.
Right. I'm completely lost on that conversation.
Yeah, well, and most people would be. You know what I'm saying? I understood the term, and you would understand terms that I use. But for anyone else who's listening who is not familiar with that, then yes, I'm the great explainer.
Yes. Wonderful.
All right. So go ahead with what you were saying about how these authors get taken advantage of very very often.
Okay. Well, there's a couple more things that a traditional commercial publisher will do. And one, there are two very, very important parts. They put a competitive cover price on each book that they put out. These vanity publishers who choose the cover prices for the authors, they generally choose a cover price that is grossly inflated. And I tell authors that they want their cover price within 10 to 20% of competing titles. So I tell authors, go to the bookstore, browse your genre section, find books that are coming out in the same format, whether it's hardback, whether it's paperback, mass trade paper, whatever they're doing. Find books in the same format and then figure out what the average is for all of those books. And then they want their cover price somewhere in that neighborhood.
Right.
And the reason why is when you're sitting at the bookstore as a buyer and you're looking at two books and they're both hardcover and they're about the same number of pages and they both have really interesting covers and the back of the book has interesting information and you want both but your gift card can only cover one of them. And you're looking at these two books and you turn it over and one of them is $25 and the other one is $50.
Mm-hmm.
Which one are you going to buy?
You're absolutely right.
Yeah,
it's unfortunate. You know, most writers think their book is that each book is unique, and of course they are right. But the reality is that when a buyer is looking, a purchaser is looking at two or three books that appear similar, though obviously not exactly right, they don't care that your book is written with great art. They care about the fact that your book is $3 more or less than the other guy's.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
So a competitive cover price makes a huge difference on whether or not your book is going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
It does. It makes a difference. To the buyer, it makes a difference. And the last one that I feel is so important is a traditional commercial publishing house will make considerable efforts towards publicizing your work. They're going to create a marketing plan for your book. They're going to send out more than a single email to a couple of your local media with your press release. They're going to be contacting radio hosts specifically targeted that cover the topics that you like. And they're going to be contacting newspapers and magazines. They're going to send out advance review copies 4 to 6 months before your release date. Before anyone can go buy your book, they're sending out these books to try to get reviews in the New York Times. They're trying to get reviews on Amazon. And they're making these efforts, and they're not charging you anything for that work. So,
And the reason they're not doing that is because they figure they're going to make money, too, on the sales of the book.
Right. A commercial publishing house, that's how they make their money.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make their money by the author paying for it. They make their money because they sell the books.
Right.
So that is really what is a large traditional commercial publishing house. That is what they're going to put into it.
And you're not necessarily advising a writer, either with a completed book or working on one, to necessarily try to go the commercial publisher route, though. Is that correct?
Sometimes it's not necessary. Sometimes
okay.
you don't need it. For example, there's authors who are writing strictly for their posterity. So if they have a family history book or if
mm-hmm.
they're writing their
sure.
World War II memoirs and all they want is something for the future generations to have and to hold, to know something about them, then a traditional commercial publishing house is not their target publisher.
Sure.
Their target publisher is a publishing company such as, say, Publish America, who does not charge authors any upfront fees to see their book in print, and they don't have to pay for anything. So an author can go to Publish America, can see their book in print quickly, and while it will have an overinflated cover price, the
mm-hmm.
author is still not incurring any charges. Another favorite of mine right now is Create Space. Create Space.
Okay.
It's an
okay.
Amazon company, and you can set everything up for, it's less than $100 after all of the settings that I would suggest as I was looking through it. You can, for $40, you get a better cut of every sale that is made, and
mm-hmm.
your book is available on Amazon for all of your friends and family to go and order.
Right.
And so I think that's a great way as well, as opposed to going to iUniverse or Ex Libris and paying $1,000 or $2,000 to get your book in print.
So this, you're saying Create Space or Create Base?
Create Space, S-P-A-C-E.
Okay. And if a writer has a book completed, they can go there and set it up for about $100, and then basically it's kind of like a print-on-demand through Amazon.
Right. And it might actually be as low as $25 for the very, very basic, just to have your book set up in their system. It's
That's great.
So little. Yeah, and compared to, you know, incurring thousands of dollars in debt, I think it's a great option.
Yeah, and there's nothing to prevent you from selling thousands of books if you're able to interest thousands of people.
Right, but for the example that I gave you, this person isn't interested
history,
in selling to the world. They're interested in their extended family to have something to have in their hands to know more about the family or more about that specific person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that situation, you don't want a large commercial publishing house.
Absolutely. Now, you're also doing publicity tip videos, is that right?
I am. I have some publicity tips on YouTube. And
mm-hmm.
if you do a search for my name, I'm pretty sure you can find them.
Okay. Yes, undoubtedly. Although, as we spoke before, I made the joke that Sabrina Assumption is such a common name that you'll find, you know, all these other Sabrina Assumptions when you make a, when you do a search. But that's something you've just done on YouTube as both a combination service and also presumably to let people know of your existence should they actually want to go forward with using Publicist service.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Well, and another
great
part of it is I'm really trying to reach out to a lot of writers groups and start to educate different authors in their writing settings about what is involved in publicity and what's involved in publishing. And so part of it is trying to get myself out in front of that audience as well.
Sure, sure. And you've done a lot of those. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say people in writers groups, in writers guilds, anyone that does a writing conference. I've been trying to encourage these groups to have workshops on writing. But in addition, after the book is written, there's more to publishing than just that. And these authors need to be aware of their options and aware of the basic marketing that they should be doing.
Okay. Now, you had on your website, this is, you know, no secret, so obviously because you put it up there, you said that one of your goals for this year that we've just begun is to hold more seminars. So with regard to marketing and publicity, so I assume you've done some of that before, and based on what you just said, that's pretty clear. If someone wanted to, because I assume it's in your areas in the middle west part of the country, that you hold these?
Well, I will actually do them nationwide.
Great.
So it doesn't have to be in the Midwest.
Okay, I see. So if someone is interested in participating in one of those, they can sign up for your newsletter and be notified of when these things are taking place and where, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and let me mention your website again. It's sabrinasumption.com, and it's sabrinasumsion.com. And in case anyone's wondering, all the letters that might sound confusing, the S, those are S as in Sam, not F as in Frank. So, again, sabrinasumption.com. I don't know that anyone will call in the remaining time we have, but in the event someone wishes to, if you have a question for Sabrina, the phone number is 347-994-3796. And should you call in with a question or comment, we will do, as they say in professional radio circles, hook you up. And we can do that. Yeah. Now, in terms of I should also add, this is very important, and I fell down on this. You also have a radio show on Blog Talk Radio. Should someone wish to listen to your show, how would they get there?
Well, blogtalkradio.com/Sabrina Assumption.
So if you knew how to spell it before.
As long as you can spell my name.
You can get there, right. And you've done interviews of people who are involved in the literary world, so to speak, in terms of things that agents want and don't want. Now, again, literary. By the way, I should have asked this earlier. How is it that a publicist differs from an agent? I know the answer, but for those who don't know, what is the difference between a publicist and an agent?
Well, there's two different kinds of agents. So the first kind of agent is the literary agent who contacts editors and arranges them to read your manuscript. So they are going to screen writing for agents and then send agents the best writing that they come across, the ones that compelled them for whatever reason. So that's a basic of what a literary agent does. It's more involved. But the other type of agent is someone who will set up paid-for venues and take a cut of ticket sales or that sort of thing. So an agent covers some of publicity because they're going to try to get public awareness for your event. They're going to try to get people there. But they are paid on the back end to set up these events for you.
I will confess that that kind of agent I'm totally unfamiliar with. I was unaware of that. So that second group will actually just set up large events like a book signing or a speaking engagement and that kind of thing and take a cut from the sales.
Yes. And I have had people approach me to do that for them, but that's not my expertise, so that's not something that I do.
So let's talk about what you actually do, that voodoo, that what you do in terms of working for authors. When you do find an author who is not going to mortgage the house, the car, and the kids just to see their name on a book, and where you think you can actually be of some service, what is it that you do for those folks?
A lot of it is individual, of course, depending on what the author wants, depending on what the author is capable of doing. I can set up book signings for that author at bookstores. Dependent upon who they published with, though, is whether or not they will get signings. One of the very biggest questions that I always tell authors to ask their publisher before signing anything is, will my book be returnable to the distributor? And this is very
important. Explain what that means. Explain what that means, if you will, briefly.
A lot of authors don't realize that when bookstores purchase books to put on their shelves, they have the option of returning that book back to the publisher or the distributor and getting a refund if the books don't sell.
Right.
And I didn't know that before I got into the industry myself.
Okay.
So if your publisher is telling the distributors that no, bookstores cannot return the books to you, and you are not going to get a refund if books are returned to you, then bookstores aren't going to order your book because it means they can't send it to the distributor.
Right, they don't want the
risk. Right, they don't want to take that risk. Also, a lot of publishers will say, hey, your book is returnable, but what they mean is that bookstores can return your book to me, the publisher. And that doesn't work for bookstores. There are hundreds of publishers in the nation. And if bookstores had to create a separate box for each publisher that they were returning books to, they would use so much postage, they would waste man hours. It would be a mess because inevitably books would get sent to the wrong people.
Sure.
So bookstores, especially Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walden Books, Books A Million, all those large chains, they say if your book is not returnable to the distributor, we're not touching
it. We're not interested. Right.
Yes. So that's an important detail to know before you hire anyone to help you with book events. Is your book returnable to the distributor? But that's
If the answer is no, effectively you're not going to have a book event in terms of a store.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Okay, I thought that's what you meant. I was summarizing. Go ahead.
Well, the large chains, it's a no way.
Right.
You can get in with some independent bookstores on a consignment basis, which means they're not ordering your book from the publisher. You have to bring the books yourself, and then they get a cut of whatever you sell at their location.
Right.
Those are really hard to set up unless you have a local bookstore which supports self-published authors.
Right, which is rare.
It can be. There are some parts of the nation where you're pulling teeth to set up any events. And so at this point, I do not represent events for any authors who are not returnable to the distributor.
Right.
It's too many hours and too little results. And I can't sleep at night because I can't get the author any results. And it's because the bookstores are not going to take them.
Okay. So in addition to setting up events, talk about what else, if you would, you do in terms of publicizing a book for the authors who would come to you that, as I say, that you decide you can help.
Well, these authors, I love to get them on radio interviews. I think
right.
radio interviews are a great way to let a lot of people know that they exist. It's great public awareness to be on the radio. I just absolutely love it.
Absolutely.
I also encourage authors to find something about themselves, and I call it the three E's of publicity, in their
mm-hmm.
experience, in their education, or in their expertise. So
okay.
whatever they focus on, whatever they have studied and have researched, and they do this for their job, if they have expertise in something, or if they have education, so maybe they went to school to be a computer scientist, but for some reason ended up as a publicist like I did,
right.
they still have computer education. And then experience is, I ran into an author who, she ended up being a caretaker for five different family members who successively,
oh.
or I'm not sure that successively is the right word, but one after another became terminally
yep.
ill. And
wow.
so that is her experience as being a caretaker. So you find
I don't know if I don't know if I'd want I don't know if I'd want to use her. It'd be a little scary.
When I talked to her, it sounded like she helped the first one because it was a very close relative, and then when the second one got sick, she kind of got guilted into doing the second one, and then by the third time, everybody just expected her to be the caretaker,
right.
and then the fourth, mm-hmm. so she really didn't plan it.
mm-hmm.
Poor lady. Oh, heart of gold, but
tough
you
situation.
Have these three areas that
mm-hmm.
you can work from, that you can draw your experience from, and you figure out what you have learned in those areas that is valuable information to pass along to others. And then you take that information and you start developing short articles, about 500 to 800 words, and then you start shopping them around to publications and you try to get your name in print. And even
right.
if these topics and areas have nothing to do with what your book is about, you're still
right.
getting publicity for your book because you have that bio at the end where
mm-hmm.
you say, Sabrina Sumption is the author of this book. For more information on Sabrina or to contact her, see her website at
right.
www.sabrinasumption.com.
Mm-hmm.
So that little blurb right there gives you that publicity that you're looking for. Maybe it's in a small way, but right now media, because of cutbacks, they're looking less to feature people. I mean, interviews
mm-hmm.
or offering them the opportunity and the privilege of interviewing you isn't getting results anymore. What they want is they want content to give to their audience because
right.
that makes them look good. And media
mm-hmm.
want to look good.
Right.
So I encourage all the authors I work with, even if they're not my clients, find something
right.
that you can write about, find content that you can offer to the media, and then in that little bio at the end, that's where you're getting your publicity for your book.
Right. By the way, this may sound peculiar for me to mention. This is my ego trip. I actually have a column in a magazine that's distributed locally, and at the end of which my website where my book is listed. And the two things this falls into what you were saying. The two things have absolutely nothing to do with one another. The column is on the subject of sex, and the book has to do with mobile home investment. So I mean, you know, there's a good example of the kind of peculiar combination you're talking about.
Right. And they can have nothing to do with each other, but you're still getting publicity for your product.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
great.
I can imagine a connection, but I don't want to talk about it on the air. Anyway. So that's essentially what you do in terms of providing the exposure, if you will, for your authors, so that they can have more people aware of them, so that in fact people are going to follow up on their own interest in the author or
right.
the book subject. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the way, let me invite you, if you have any authors who you wish to have interviewed, you know, let me know. I will be happy to put them on.
I've got a list.
Oh.
Thank you a lot, actually. I'll send you an email.
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah, please. That'll work great. In the meantime, Let me mention your website again. And by the way, the website that you have is very informative and interesting. That's not something I had to say, but I'm telling you that both in terms of references to your radio show and in terms of just some of the subjects. Let me mention some of the subjects that you mentioned on your website for those who are interested. Talking about the law, you were talking about in March, for example, you're going to launch The Lost Secret to Lucrative Writing. Well, I will tell you that anybody who is thinking about writing or is interested in business, that's going to be something that people will tend to glom onto. But it also refers to interviews you've done on your show. It talks about there's a link to your internal site, 4 P's of marketing and publicity tips, talking about things that agents hate. We spoke briefly before about agents, but all of that stuff is right there on your website. So let me mention that again. It is Sabrina Sumption, SabrinaSumption.com. The website will lead people to you and will lead people also to just information. One of the great things about a commercial website is that if you are giving things away in terms of information, it makes the commercial site more appealing.
Yes.
I agree. As a matter of fact, there are stories I'm sure you've heard about authors who will, for example, serialize their book free or will provide the book free on the web in terms of chapters you link to and you read, and the book still sells, which has always stricken me as odd.
Yeah, it is odd. But some people just love a book. And in my Writers Guild, we have a listserv, and we discuss topics like this. And it's just the feeling of having that book in your hand is much different than reading it on a computer screen.
Yeah.
And that's
no,
why
no
the book sells, because people just want it in their hands. And I want to also mention on my website, people who register on it, and the registration is free, they have access to all of my publicity tips that I send out randomly. And I'm not kidding when I say it's random. It's in the middle of the night, I may think of one, and then it gets sent out. So they get access to that, and then they can sign up for the newsletter where these publicity tips are sent directly to their email box. And I'm not, I don't sell people. It's not just saying, hey, I've got this deal on publicity, so come hire me. It's, hey, here's another idea for a way to get in front of the public and get name awareness.
That's great. We are just about out of time. I know you have that experience on your show, too, that the time goes by. Hopefully, the time goes by quickly, because it means you have a good guest and interesting subjects, and it's holding your attention. And that's what's happened here with me in terms of a conversation with you. We've been talking to Sabrina Sumption again last time, SabrinaSumption.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciated the opportunity.
Thank you. It's been a joy, and I'll hopefully talk to you again soon. And do send me that list if you wish of anyone you'd like to have on. All right. So thank you. I'll disconnect you in a minute. And if you are interested, go to her website, SabrinaSumption.com. Thanks again. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And we have about a minute and a half theoretically left, and I want to thank obviously, I've thanked her on air, but let me thank her when she's not here. Sabrina Sumption, again, SabrinaSumption.com is her site. If you're a writer or thinking of writing something, or you have something ready to publish, or you have already printed your book, you might find her services useful, or at the very least, finding her free tip useful. Do join us next week. Next week is the 14th. And we will have another guest. We will be having the guest who was originally going to be on tonight, Nicole of the Android Guys. And she's going to talk to us about Android phones and Android systems. If you join us again, we would be honored, flattered, and extremely pleased. We would thank our producer, Autumn Bushman. But unfortunately, she slept through the program, as probably some of you did. Thank you very much, and have a great week. See you next time, Thursday night. Bye-bye.